Are you using the KFAI mobile app? If not, you're missing out on the easiest way to bring fresh air with you wherever you go. Stream live and archive programs and podcasts directly from your smartphone, tablet, or other mobile device. Our most recent app updates includes a link to your KFAI member card, which offers you special discounts at participating member businesses all over the Twin Cities. Find the KFAI mobile app on Google Play and the App Store.
Sanctuary, Arts and Activism, heard only on KFAI Fresh Air Radio, 41 years of radio without boundaries. Heard locally at 90.3 FM, HD in Minneapolis, and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Melissa Olson. I'll be your host today on Sanctuary, Arts and Activism, interviews and conversations about creative activism. This is the episode for Monday, April 8th, 2019. Sanctuary is pre-recorded in studio here at KFAI on top of the Bailey Building, here on the west bank of the Mississippi River in the heart of the Cedar Riverside neighborhood. On this episode of Sanctuary, an interview with Rory Wakeemup, an artist and activist based out of St. Paul. Rory and I spent the better part of an hour last week talking about a new initiative taking off in Minnesota and across the United States called Reclaiming Native Truth. Rory is one of several artists leading an effort to create more visibility for Native people. Rory and others intend to bring a more balanced, nuanced understanding of Native people in education, philanthropy, pop culture, media, and governance. In the interview, Rory talks a little bit about recent testimony he provided to the Minnesota House and Minnesota Senate on the American Indian Arts and Cultural Heritage Bill. At the end of the hour, I will also bring you a story I recently reported for Miniculture, KFAI's art and culture program. The story is about a new documentary film and its Minnesota premiere at the upcoming Minneapolis and St. Paul International Film Festival. We will also hear from Lori Stern of Minnesota Native News about all things sous chef As Lori interviews Sean Sherman's team, we'll learn a little bit more from these chefs about some of the foods and some of the teachings that they grew up with. Before we start with the interview, special thanks to Rico Morales for engineering and recording our recent in-studio with Rory. Rory and I spoke for just over 40 minutes this past week. Thanks for coming on today, Rory.
You're welcome.
So for our guests who will not have met you, could you introduce yourself a little bit?
Ooh, I have a great line. I shouldn't have had it out. Long story short, activist, artist, and community organizer. Not necessarily in that order, just depending on what's going on.
Yeah. And could you tell me a little bit about your recent work in terms of your artistic production?
Yeah, there's three facets. I did a permanent piece installation at Augsburg College in the Hagfer Center on the third floor. Bunch of infinite reflections in one-way glass and neon called Ceremony Fire, titled. And then I do performances with youth where we use satire and appropriate pop culture and mix that with our powwow regalia and make outfits, a hybrid of costume and regalia, because you never cross those, mix those words up in our community. So I mix it up intentionally and then call them outfits, neither costume or regalia. And we decapitate the heads of racist mascots and oil snakes, but not kill the being, more like wake them up. And, you know, they take those heads off and become normal human beings, and then we celebrate and dance together in a round dance. And then there's the community art tent / community art trailer, where majority of the time it's bring your own fabric and we'll screen print for free. And I have about 10 to 15 different images now of social justice and environmental justice messaging. And then in the rare case, I'll ask for donations for fundraising, but usually there's grants for it.
And how long have you been working as an artist, Rory?
I was a professional student, so I don't really count those 10 to 15 years of undergrad and graduate studies as being a professional. Mm-hmm. But everything all included, like 20 years, but really out of academia for only 3-4.
Awesome. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your recent work with the We Are Still Here Minnesota that is coming out of some of the illuminative work that is being done by Crystal Echohawk and Echohawk Consulting. They have sort of convened a group of Native artists, thought leaders, allies, and other folks to capitalize on the findings of the Reclaiming Native Truth. And Reclaiming Native Truth is a large public opinion research piece, an initiative that is really trying to change the narrative around Native people in pop culture, media, education, and so forth. And I know they recently had the We Are Still Here Minnesota conference. Can you tell me a little bit about what your experience was in attending it?
Yeah. And just to add a little more on the study, it was a $3 million national study. And the four sections are philanthropy, K-12 education, governance, and pop culture media, / I like to include arts in that pop culture media. Crystal and a cohort of others are starting a national campaign starting a national campaign. And since Minneapolis is kind of the hub of Native activism, they thought it'd be good to start here. And not only that, there's a good number of us already working to change those fields, here in Minnesota anyway. So it's just kind of a natural fit. And the convening was put together by the Native Governance Center, in collaboration with Susan Hernandez from McKnight, Ramona Stately from Indian Ed, and myself, and Wayne from the Native Governance Center. And we brought together, our goal was to get 100 of the change makers here in Minnesota together, and I think it ended up being about 70 on a Chokmi. Pretty good turnout. And we separated, you know, the first day was more just folks talking about the work they do that relates. And Crystal kind of filled everyone in on the study and the her work in Illuminative, and talked about the Freiberg studies and you know, all that, I guess, Indian 102, you know, the stuff a little more in-depth than the Indian 101s, but still should be common knowledge, even though it isn't.
Are there pieces of data that stand out to you as especially important in that work that comes out of the Illuminative for the Reclaiming Native Truth?
Yeah, I just testified to the Senate yesterday, and the 3 points I use are that this invisibility is a bias against Natives. And I before this, my thing was invisibility is the new racism, you know, so that they word it better. I should look at them because I'm kind of paraphrasing, but long story short, the 78% of those studied want to know more about Native truths, and they understand that K-12 education is wrong. They just don't know how or why. And so basically the study codifies or confirms everything that Native people know and experience every day, but you put a $3 million effort behind it, and then, you know, folks listen. They, you know, it's not just one person bringing it up. It's, you know, bona fide, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It goes beyond anecdotal at that point.
Right, exactly. And to, you know, in philanthropy, governance, and K-12 education, that they need those numbers and statistics, you know. So that was the first step in being visible. Now it's getting our narratives into K-12 education, pop culture, and arts is most important to me.
You mentioned that art for you comes in the pop culture and media portion of the effort. How does it fit in for you?
Just in my undergrad, I was kind of spoiled. I was over 10 years at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and it was really more my reservation off the reservation or home away from home. And I just ran into so many Native folks, like just an eclectic range of tribes and indigenous folks that from around Turtle Island and the world sometimes, Maori folks included, that I didn't see how invisible we were because I was just in my own Native bubble for so long. And then when I went to grad school at UW-Madison, I realized how bleak Native arts are in the world, though my bubble was popped. And no one understood any of even the core arts that all Indigenous folks kind of adhere to and admire and like. And they just, they glazed over and it turned into this, Indian artist kitsch. I was like, oh, all right, I'll show you kitsch. And then I just blew kitsch in their face with a kitsch glitter bomb of neon and glass. And, you know, I owned it and flipped the script on it. And then it started with more of just the only, it's more like pop culture has like a sexual fetish with us. And even literally in like our missing and murdered Indigenous women, right? It's deep-seated sick fetish. So originally my alter ego, Darth Chief, the mascot hunter, was going to sexually fetishize like Chief Illiniwek, because they're like their whole campaign to save the chief and all this stuff. I was like, you guys care more about a superficial mascot based in a fallacy than real chiefs and Indians mm-hmm. and Native people. So I was going to sexually fetishize their chief and use that as saying, I'm honoring your mascot. That's how, you know, by flipping that script kind of inform, you know, so they get the feeling of what it's like for your mm-hmm. your regalia and your chiefs and your history to be fetishized like that, you know, in such an abusive mm-hmm. manner. And they got it, but then kids kind of adhered to the Star Wars aspect of it, and I cut the graphic nature of it and settled it down to just decapitating the heads of these mascots that are still sold on online, you know, and like Chief Wahoo, that's a pretty blatantly racist.
Right, it's icon. Everywhere.
Right.
It's just everywhere.
Right, and it's banned and for any other color to be of that image except for red. And it's right. Spot on with the stuff the Germans, you know, or Hitler's Nazi campaign, you know, that was that big nose, you know, greedy Jew kind of thing. And this is this big nose, stupid Indian thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So dehumanizing, you know, that's at the core of everything I battle against in the arts.
Sanctuary is heard only on KFAI Fresh Air Radio, 41 years of radio without boundaries. I'm your host, Melissa Olson. We'll be right back after these messages.
Have you been thinking of starting your own custom product online business? Well, Printify is here for all your custom product needs. Printify is a print-on-demand network where you can create and sell custom products from clothing apparel, wall art, home decor, accessories, and a whole lot more. But get this, Printify does the printing and shipping for you. Yeah, that's right. They do the printing and shipping for you. That makes life a whole lot easier. To get started, just go to printify.com. And don't forget to use special $5 off code KFAI5. That's capital letters KFAI with the number 5.
You are listening to Sanctuary, and I'm your host, Melissa Olson. Be sure and say locked in after Sanctuary. There's lots more to follow. Let's now return to my recent interview with Rory Wakeemup.
And so when you look at this new work or this this work that's being done by Illuminative that builds on some of the work that you've been doing, you and others, where do you see it going in the present and where do you hope it goes?
Well, just in the last couple years, the community arts screen printing, like, our community shows up for free swag like none other, you know. So
you can really get your message out there right. If you know that fact alone.
Right. Yeah. No, it's kind of a double positive, you know.
Absolutely.
So not only do our Native people love this messaging and supporting a good cause, but then they get free swag and then can turn an old shirt into something super cool, you know. So for the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's March, I think in the last 2 years, we've printed between 2,000 and 3,000 items, bandanas and shirts. There's the water protector shirts, probably between 1,000 and 2,000 shirts. So between the two, well over four, like 1,000 every 6 months, I'd say. And that's all community volunteers. I try to pay volunteer stipends to folks that help, but most often I don't get to pay folks. So we all just get, and then the grants I spend out of my own pocket, because grants never cover enough, you know.
You know, that brings me to something that I was chatting with Sarah Egerton Howes about. And it has to do with sort of this recent report that's been released by Creative Minnesota. Now, we hadn't had a chance to talk about this, you and I, so I won't throw out a lot of stuff about that. But I'm, you know, one of the things that I was really curious about is a statistic that they quote here for artists and creative workers. In all of the districts throughout Minnesota that they use to sort of fund different nonprofits and advocacy arts organizations, across the entire state, this report counts 153 Native artists, which is, to my mind, just incredibly low and undercounted. And a lot of it has to do, you know, one of the things I'm planning on asking Sarah, but I'll ask you too, is at what point did you begin to see yourself as an artist? And how does seeing yourself as an artist sort of change the way that you interact with the world in terms of being able to get support for your work, in terms of being able to get funding, in terms of being able to support others?
Yeah, that's basically, I could read off my 2-3 minute testimony to the House and Senate I just did. But to go deeper beyond that, even census or in public schools, if you identify as multicultural, Native's part of it, the Native part is dropped and you're just labeled whatever else you identified as in both schools and federal census. So that right there is one.
This sort of identifying as Native in combination with one or more races, is that the census question?
Right, so I'm Native and Irish, and if I put Irish, they don't include that I'm Native, even though I'm enrolled. They just put the Irish. Same with schools. So that's used a lot to be like, well, you're such a small group. What, we don't need to give you any special services? So that's the first thing, right? It's the first barrier, that invisibility. And then, you know, through genocide and forced assimilation, lots of folks denied being Native got off the enrollments and hid, blended in. So there's, you know, folks out there that probably could be enrolled that aren't. You know, they might not even know it. I know one artist I work with, she didn't know until she got a letter about some land issue dispute. She's like, oh, I didn't know I was from Red Lake, you know? So, I mean, there's it's really deep-seated, really systemic of all, and just every person has every Native person has their own experience and story when it comes to identity or that confusion, you know. But when it comes in, gets into philanthropy and public funding, there was 2 years ago on NPR a discussion about funds or lack of funds. One of the subjects was lack of funds going to Native peoples. We're about 1-2% of the population enrolled, and then descendancy, probably, you know, 5 or more. And then those that identify, you know, go up from there. But as far as Native folks that even self-identify, the funding is very low, like lower than even the number that's enrolled, lower than that 2%. So if you look at like State Arts Board, you know, I'm not gonna name names, but there's folks in there that don't, I've never heard them self-identify. I gotta talk to them, I know these folks. and I'm kind of digging in the data now, but there's folks in organizations that don't even qualify to self-identify, and I don't know how those numbers got in there. But looking in that data, even of that one, a little more than 1% going to Native artists, half of that's definitely not Natives or descendants of Minnesota Natives for a Minnesota State Arts Board grant from Legacy. So that 150 there, that's kind of a higher number than I thought, really. Yeah, no, that's they probably were more encompassing than most organizations are. Yeah, 150 is impressive. Because I ran a gallery for 2 years and finding, you know, that's about how many artists I know of, you know.
So that number rings true for you.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking like this fine art thing.
So that, right? I want to ask you about that. So I think one of the potential sort of ways to evaluate this data has to do with who identifies as an artist.
Right.
And if folks are saying, you know, I'm a Native person, I make things, that's just who I am, that's just part of my culture,
right.
They may not identify themselves as an artist.
Right. Well, it's just, I mean, even ingrained in our genetic memory, we've never separated art from life. You give someone a flower, that's, you know, that aromatherapy or whatever these explanations of what's happening in that exchange, that's just life in helping spirits and just, you know what I'm saying? But then in Anishinaabe, there's these whole words that are like a sentence long that could explain that. But I don't know the language. So we're caught between these worlds of, you know, in our language, you know, to describe blueberry pie, there's a word that basically is so long it teaches you how to make it.
The art is in the word itself.
Right, yeah. So it's like, yeah, language is very much arts if you really look at it. So so these non-Native perspectives put these categories and walls on things to keep us out of their circles. And even like in my statement to the House and Senate was, you know, for the longest time now, or since the history of museums in the United States or on Turtle Island, any influence of European materials or concept in our lives or work was deemed inauthentic, even though we have, in the Midwest, we've had shells part of our ceremonies as long as I've ever heard of, you know, that aren't local here. They're from the oceans. So we've had these barter trade systems that have been ingrained in our art and ceremonies, and adapting that into our lives is who we are. We're very much adapting and evolving all the time with materials. So to just cut that all off as soon as Europeans get here and then everything's inauthentic, kill us off, and then anything afterwards is ideologically corrupt, is racist, you know, and they've been doing that. And then they took control of our narratives. They took control of our art. They took, and you know, our first American great painters, you know, are white guys influenced by Navajo sand paintings and all this Native art and experience, and this ethereal stuff that they're getting from Native culture in their art. That's fine American, fine white art, but Natives do it. No, that's whatever, ideologically corrupt, and it ain't art. You know, so there's these double standards. And to go further on, those guys butcher it. White guys butcher ethereal. I'll just tell you that. And they obviously butchered the whole concept of Navajo sand painting with his drunken splash messes, you know what I'm saying? But that's fine, America.
Right.
Anyway, I could go on and on.
Right.
So it's So my argument, or our argument, is, you know, like, let us decide for ourselves. Let us make our own categories. Give us that narrative back, you know? And it's going to be amazing, long story short. And quit dehumanizing us in Hollywood. Inform folks in K-12 education that we're still here and we're movers and shakers in community, astronauts, athletes, doctors, lawyers, artists, like, we're ingrained. But the only time we're given any publicity is these, look at these angry activists in the way of progress, you know? It's because we're standing up for our social justice or for our environment, you know? And we're demonized for it. Hence why my alter ego is a villain, but with a silver outfit. So they villainize it, so I'm owning that villainy for good, you know, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a couple of times that you've just went in front of the Minnesota House and Senate on a bill. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. Independently, Oyate Hatonin and myself were kind of working on public funding because we knew we weren't, and Sharon Day and other artists knew that we're not getting funds. And they say they're reporting all this, but when we look into it, it's like, all right, I won't go into it. It's not us. It's not our artwork, you know. One part of that testimony is like, since we're not the gatekeepers of those opportunities, to get those opportunities, we have to appease those gatekeepers, and that perpetuates the stereotype. So, as beautiful as a majority of those artists' artwork is getting those grants, it's still that what we're taught in undergrad and grad school or anywhere is like, you have to conform to this European style of art if you're going to be considered an artist. And those that don't conform to that just don't get funds. And that's European art with a little native lemon spritzer on it. You know what I'm saying? And some do very well getting native concepts into the work. And then,
so yeah. The bill in this sense is to fund or to make some funding available to a community of artists that can then for themselves say, this is what we're doing. These are our ideas. These are the things that we would like for people to know about our art.
Right. So just quick reference to that 157 artists, the finer that classify as artists, that number multiply it by 20, and that's how many artists we'll have in our books. That's crafts people, folks making stuff for ceremonies, powwows, regalia, maybe even language. I mean, we're going to, depending on where we go with it, but it's not up to me. If we get the funds, we're already starting a task force from this convening that we did. It's, you know, philanthropy money slow. But to keep the wind in the sails, we're just going to start volunteering and making sure we keep a pulse on everyone's interest and everyone informed. And then and getting an online network going from this convening. But so this task force, I hope, will kind of just start off real loose and just, you know, because if we get the funds, it's going to be quick turnaround. We asked for, I think, like $3 to $5 million a year for the next 10 years of that legacy funding. And that's statewide, so that's a lot of responsibility, but then that's compared to the peanut shells we get compared to that annually. I think if we get the funds, and that matches our population percentage. So we're not getting more than our fair share. That's just our fair share. That's how much is out there in public funds, just State Arts Board.
Right. So that is what equity is at that level.
Right. Exactly. And right now they say they're equitable and all that stuff. And it's like, no, assimilation's not equity. You know, you want us to go by your rules, your definitions, and all that to be equitable. And it's still not equitable. It's still not equal. And we still have to jump through your hoops. And, like, we don't, a lot of times we don't even qualify. I'm like, they have so many rules, we don't qualify to apply. And there's no way to get into that wheelhouse of being able to qualify, because we're stuck in this low barrier. And it's pretty common with other people of color to be stuck in these smaller project grants, but not organizational or operational support grants.
What I find so interesting is that, you know, even Creative Minnesota is saying things like, the study found that combined economic impact of nonprofit arts organizations, their audiences, and artists, creative workers in Minnesota, that economic impact is now over $2.1 billion annually. And that the state sees something like $245 million back. Local and state government revenue from arts exceeded $245 million. So when you put money into the arts economy, the state benefits.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, markets. Yeah, you name it. Yeah, no, I get invited to go to markets all the time. I don't sell work, though. My art isn't about selling it. I mean, if I were to sell my alter ego, I'd be selling out like anyone. I don't want anyone wearing that or hanging it on their walls.
And that's not to say it's about the dollars and cents necessarily, but it sounds like that investing in the arts is a pretty solid, sound investment from the state's point of view.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, but when you, so I'm not a market artist, but their markets out there attract crowds. You know, it's coast to coast. There are huge art markets that states bank on heavily for their tourist dollars. I would just venture to guess that Minnesota's maybe behind the other leaders of states with art markets. So I think we could probably, I think there's untapped potential in the funds that could be made, you know.
And what do you think that the impact then overall, and that's including the economic benefit, but what do you think that what is the impact that you hope to see for the community, for the work that you're doing at the state legislature, for the work that you're doing through your own work and then Illuminative? What do you hope some of those outcomes are?
Well, in 1935, Roosevelt, I think that was the year, came up with the first Indian Arts and Crafts Act. And that was designed to get money into Native American hands, because everything was illegal for us back then, except for art and powwows. Or that kind of, you know, where we had to separate our culture, because our culture was illegal, so we had to do these European...
Para forms of cultural expression.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there was no law behind it enforcing it, so folks kind of took advantage and just said it was Indian. And I say Indian and American Indian because that's legal terms in government, American Indian or Indian. Saying that it was Indian made when it wasn't, and there was... another round of Indian Arts and Crafts Act that I believe it's Dr. Harjo helped write and get that through in the 80s. They started in the 70s, I'm pretty sure. And then I think it was ratified in the 80s. But that really put some teeth to it. There's an Indian Arts and Crafts Board. And also it's part of, I think, the FBI to investigate fraud, and it's up to $250,000 fine. Which I'm starting to look into how that applies in public funds and philanthropy. Because if they, that's why I'm doing all this research. I've been doing it for a year now, just slowly picking away at it. But they're stepping all over the purpose and intent of Indian Arts and Crafts Act. So whether or not they have to abide by it, because it's more about this exchange and sale and promotion, where this is just, I guess, grants and gifting. I got to see if, and maybe it's time for a third Arts and Crafts Act.
That would cover sort of philanthropy.
Right, and I'm trying to figure out if it does now, depending on, long story short, I'm gathering information and going to give it to Pipestem Law Firm to probably look at this summer and then see if there's either, and I really don't want to burn bridges, mm-hmm. but, if equity's not found in this effort here, equity, I'll find it. I am sick of being invisible and overlooked, and other people being the gatekeeper of our culture and authorities of our culture. It's time's up. So that's like when I first met, because folks heard what I was doing independently and they invited me to speak to this convening last year. And when I saw the study and the intention of it, I was like, finally, reinforcements have arrived. I'm not going to be a dog barking at this squirrel in the tree alone. We have a pack and we'll go on shifts. The equity, a little squirrel equity is, going to either be stuck in that tree forever or is going to have to come down. And that's a bad metaphor. Should put it another. But anyway.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is really interesting in the sense that, the Arts and Crafts Act are really meant to make sure that what is created by Native folks is benefiting Native folks economically and, through the ability for them to build careers based on their own practice.
Exactly.
And that but sounds like, and I guess I believe this to be true, and you can tell me what you think, that the sort of front that you have to work on two fronts. One is making sure that the Arts and Craft Act is enforced, and then making sure that artists are getting sort of the funds that are available publicly to everyone in an equitable way. And that is going to require even the Arts and Crafts Act to maybe be updated.
Correct. It's a big effort.
Yeah, you're fighting on two fronts.
Well, yeah, and then also not only that, but folks that that are tokenizing. A lot of the time, I see it all, and it's frustrating. Even our allies, people of color, other organizations are tokenizing. They're like, oh, and at the end of the application, we're going to find an Indian to be part of it. It's like, that's not, you don't get the funds and include a Native person after you already decided what the project is. Like, you get them in on the beginning. Like, you find it, the first month I was, as director of the gallery, I got calls off the hook, like, oh, we got these grants, we need a Native artist. Like, no, you should have got the Native artist before the grant, and they should have informed what you're going to do, not you dictating to them what they're going to do. Like, that's at best tokenizing, at worst just flat out
exploitation.
Exactly. I don't know of a Native artist that has much money, so any opportunity, you're like, okay, bite the bullet, pay the bills, get it done. Perpetuates the stereotype. It's out of our control. Are we artists or not? And we got to conform and adhere to those opportunities and those gatekeepers. But that's exactly what this movement's about, is reclaiming that as our own and being our own gatekeepers. And then really having a task force busting out folks. So I hope this task force comes up with guidelines for us to follow. And, if you want to dance for pay, dance for pay. But just know if the organization that's paying you to dance isn't giving history or any context behind it, and you're just showing up to bedazzle, which I love the word bedazzle. I shouldn't use that word. Then just know the organization's probably, we're going to and they're going to hear about it. You know, it's tokenizing. But I don't want to negatively affect Native artists, though, or artists. That's not what this is about. This is about our narrative being out there and us not being invisible unless we're some type of tokenized attraction, you know? We're more than that, and we deserve better.
Rory Wakemup, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
This is Sanctuary, Arts and Community Advocacy, heard only on KFAI Fresh Air Radio, 41 years of radio without boundaries. I'm your host, Melissa Olson. We'll be right back with more after these messages.
Love listening to your favorite podcast? Why not learn to make your own? The Pavic Museum is pleased to offer a new, fun summer camp experience.
Over 3 days, students will create, produce, and perform their own podcast, which will be posted online and also aired on KFAI's Wave Project. They will learn the history of electronic communication while performing classic radio genres such as science fiction, mystery, and comedy.
This camp is recommended for students aged 9 to 13. It will take place June 12th through the 14th, 2019. For more information, call 952-926-8198 or visit pavicmuseum.org.
You're back at Sanctuary, here on KFAI Fresh Air Radio, heard locally at 90.3 FM HD in Minneapolis and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm your host, Melissa Olson. Be sure and check out Sanctuary Arts and Activism Facebook page and like it to get updates on future episodes, guests, and news about creative activism. Special thanks to Rory Wakemup for joining me in studio earlier this week. We end our show with two short stories. The first, a story I reported for KFAI's Mini Culture, about a new film premiering in Minnesota for the first time. And the second, a story from Lori Stern of Minnesota Native News about all things sous chef.
Welcome to KFAI's Mini Culture. At Mini Culture, we find intriguing arts, culture, and history stories around town and around the state. The government has a history of taking Native children from their families. It started with boarding schools, then later the Indian Adoption Project, an effort to get white families to raise Native kids. A new documentary film explores the reverberations of those policies. It's called Blood Memory.
In Minneapolis, I'm Melissa Olson. Drew Nicholas never dreamed he'd make a movie about Native Americans, but a chance conversation in a Pittsburgh coffee shop changed that.
In 2010, I had just graduated from film school, and I'm sitting in a coffee shop. This woman overheard me talking about filmmaking with my friends and said, you know, I have a story for you, and started telling me about the history of adoption, which had brought her to Pennsylvania in Pittsburgh from here in Minnesota.
Turns out the woman was a Native adoptee. While other customers played with their phones, she told Nicholas about how the U.S. government had removed Indian children from their families and culture. It began in the 1870s with boarding schools, and later the Indian Adoption Project, an effort designed to place Native kids with white parents.
And I had never heard about the boarding schools. My idea of adoption was this beautiful, life-saving thing. So in that quick little coffee shop conversation, my sort of perspective of the world around me really kind of cracked open all at once. Not being like, wow, I'm 21 and I don't know this major piece of history. In fact, I don't know any indigenous history at all. So that was sort of the nugget, the little spark that I needed to give Sandy a call.
Sandy is Sandy Whitehawk. She's the founder of First Nations Repatriations Institute, a group that helps Native people adopted by white families reconnect with their culture. Then Nicholas met Native filmmaker Elizabeth Day. Nicholas and Day worked together to make a documentary about the legacy of forced adoption. It's called Blood Memory.
In our DNA lies that code that makes up who we are. I know anyone who returns to their homeland, whether they've been adopted or not, feel that reconnect.
Every time I see this film, I'm filled with emotion.
That's Elizabeth Day.
Feel all the feels. I feel the entire range of questioning, to angry, to sadness, to happiness, and comfort.
Day was born on the Leech Lake Reservation and raised in the Twin Cities. In making Blood Memory, Nicholas and Day had really tough choices to make.
We've narrowed it down to the two central storylines, that being Sandy Whitehawk's story of her removal and Mark Fidler's work working in the Indian child welfare law world.
Fidler doesn't think placing Native kids with white families is necessarily bad. He's a lawyer and a tribal citizen of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa. He's also an outspoken critic of ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act. ICWA says Native children in need of foster care or adoption should be placed with Native families. Again, Drew Nicholas.
What's interesting is you have Mark, who is his father was in boarding schools, was a military guy. Mark grew up in the Minneapolis burbs. In a lot of ways, there's a lot of similar identity questions that he explores in the film that Sandy, who was removed through adoption, is exploring herself. And I thought, this is really interesting. You have someone who spent their whole life trying to reconnect to their culture. And then you had someone that spent weekends driving to the reservation, but yet feels this same sort of disconnect in that way. So how does that tie together?
As a white guy, Nicholas says making Blood Memory has been both a personal journey and one he's taken alongside Native communities.
I think in many ways, the film's meant to sort of create more questions than it answers. When I first started this, it was white people need to know about this unknown history, right? But then as you started making the film and visiting with people and working with, you know, the community to tell this story, it's like, oh no, this needs to be talked about in Indian country as well.
For KFAI, I'm Melissa Olson.
The movie Blood Memory will be screening at the Minneapolis International Film Festival on Wednesday, April 10th and Thursday, April 11th. On Wednesday, it screens at 7 o'clock, and then Thursday, it screens at 4:15 in the afternoon. Both screenings will be at St. Anthony, Maine. Support for Miniculture is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
This week on Minnesota Native News, a celebration of all things sous chef. This is Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. On May 5th, the James Beard Foundation will present one of only five 2019 Leadership Awards to Minneapolis-based chef Sean Sherman, Oglala Lakota from Pine Ridge. The award celebrates visionaries who are working to create healthier, more sustainable food systems. Michelle Obama has won the award, and so has poet Wendell Berry and chef Alice Waters. In making the award, the James Beard Foundation honors Sean Sherman's work to revitalize indigenous foods. But as Laurie Stern reports, the sous chef is more than one man.
We did rabbit like this. We braised it and everything. We'd go out, hunt it, and we would actually braise it like this.
Chef Darius Willard is pouring water over pieces of rabbit laid out in a braising pan. He's been braising rabbit since he was 8 years old. He used to watch his grandmother cook this way.
When I was young, I used to say, oh, that's a rabbit, you know, like, because I was so young, I didn't really know. But she said, this is what we lived off of when we were younger, you know. This is what we had to eat when we had nothing.
So Chef Darius says he learned how to cook the way she did. He grew up in Busby, Montana, on the Cheyenne River Reservation, where he ate a lot of potatoes and deer meat cooked by the sun.
My grandma was telling me when she got older, she said, well, as soon as we go, a lot of the stories, the food is going to go with us. So it's us, our job to pass it down to you guys.
Darius moved to Minneapolis for work, and by 2015, he was working with Chef Sean Sherman on the Tatanka food truck, serving healthy indigenous food around the Twin Cities. The truck moved up to White Earth, and the sous chef moved on. Now Darius works for the sous chef's catering company.
Everyone calls Sean the sous chef, and people just like that intuitively, but he never meant for it to be a moniker for himself. We consider everyone on our team to be a sous chef.
That's Dana Thompson, Wahpeton, Sisseton, and Midwakaton, Dakota. She co-owns the sous chef and has done much of the strategic planning that led to its current success. The catering company is just the beginning, she says.
I'm also the executive director of the nonprofit called Natifs, which stands for North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems. The nonprofit Natives itself has two main focuses. One is Indigenous food access, and one is Indigenous food education, so that we can look at all of the Indigenous peoples from Mexico all the way up into Alaska.
Natives will open an Indigenous food lab, a training kitchen, where tribal people from all over North America come to learn and share traditional, sustainable, healthy ways of cooking and eating. So, no to beef, pork, chicken, wheat flour, refined sugar. Yes to bison and venison, plums, chokecherries, wild rice, and so many herbs and vegetables.
Super delicious, super nutrient dense, packed with flavonoids and antioxidants, and all of this food is literally medicine.
Natives Training Kitchen will try to buy as many ingredients as possible from native sources. That way, it will promote fishing, foraging, and agriculture in tribal communities, traditional ways of gathering food, and then, of course, preparing it.
Because once we get this Indigenous food lab open, we're going to want people to come and learn about this stuff so that they can take that knowledge back to their own communities and develop their own businesses. A key part of what we're trying to do is to drive wealth into Indian country as quickly as we can.
I do want to stay out here and everything, but at the same time, when I get older and everything, I do want to bring something back to my tribe.
That's Darius Willard again, working on his braised rabbit. He says there is no conflict between working as a chef at the sous chef and bringing his skills back home to his community. In fact, it's exactly what Natives aims to do. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Lori Stern.
The sous chef is also partnering with the Minneapolis Park System to open a for-profit restaurant overlooking St. Anthony Falls. The restaurant is part of a large new park called Waterworks, a place to learn about the history of Minneapolis and the Dakota history that came first. The new restaurant is expected to open in about a year. You can learn more by going to sous-chef.com. This is Minnesota Native News. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at MN Native News.
The new documentary film, Blood Memory, will be screening at the upcoming Minneapolis and St. Paul International Film Festival on April 10th and 11th at 7 p.m. at St. Anthony Main Theater, and again on Thursday, April 11th at 4:30 at the St. Anthony Main Theater. For more information and ticketing, visit the Minneapolis and St. Paul International Film website. And thanks to Drew Nicholas and Elizabeth Day for agreeing to be interviewed. At the top of the episode, you heard music from Scatter Their Own and their song Taste of Time. We end our program today with the last part of that song. I want to give a big shout out and thank you to Rico Morales for helping to record this episode of Sanctuary Arts and Activism. If you missed any of this episode, you can hear it again for up to 2 weeks in the KFAI archives at kfai.org and look for the On Demand button. This has been Sanctuary for April 8th, 2019. Thanks for listening.